Herzlich willkommen, liebe Formel 1-Fans, zu Formel Schmidt. Auch in der Winterpause versorgen wir euch mit spannenden Themen aus der Welt der Formel 1. Unser Experte Michael Schmidt war unterwegs, um mit den Großen der Formel 1-Geschichte zu sprechen. Heute trifft Michael Schmidt Damon Hill. Er setzte mit seinem WM-Titel 1996 das Erbe seines Vaters fort. Im Gespräch verrät der Engländer, wie er seine Teamkollegen Alain Prost und Ayrton Senna erlebt hat. Warum er sich an der Kollision mit Michael Schumacher 1994 in Adelaide eine Mitschuld gibt und dass er nach seinem Rücktritt 1999 Depressionen hatte. Viel Spaß bei Michael Schmidt trifft Damon Hill.
Hallo liebe Motorsportfreunde, zu einer neuen Folge von unserem Formel 1 Stammtisch in der Wintersaison. Heute mit Damon Hill. Ich glaube, jeder kennt ihn, Weltmeister von 1996, Sohn von Graham Hill, der zweimal Weltmeister war und der große Gegner von Michael Schumacher Mitte der 90er Jahre. Hello Damon.
Michael, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks that you are joining the program here. Well, and we would like to talk to you in this wonderful place. I have to say we are here near Brooklands or in the Brooklands complex.
Yeah.
About your career and also of about the current days. Cool. So first of all, people would like to know, they know that you are Formula One expert for Sky in England. What else are you doing?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I try to keep my activities not too complicated. So I'm quite happy with the role I have with Sky. So following Formula One is pretty much a full-time business these days. So much to learn, as you know. I have, since retiring from racing, I've had a couple of projects I've done. So one of them was working with Silverstone to help the British Grand Prix, keep the British Grand Prix, and also set up some work with some charities that I do because my son has learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so I've been involved in that, fundraising. And then I do various things, like sometimes I do talks and speaking engagements to people.
Okay. You are now sitting on the other side of the fence. You are in our club, the Journalist Club.
I am.
How was that transition to become a member of our club?
Yeah.
Probably we had been a pain in the neck sometimes for you when you had been active.
Yeah, I think, I don't remember you being a pain in the neck, Michael, but there's certainly, it is a part of the job which is a difficult bit to get used to when you're a driver. You don't like the intrusion. I particularly didn't like the people asking me personal questions about my life. I didn't want to talk about my life other than do my racing. And so when I got the job with Sky, it was very difficult to make the transition from being someone who you didn't want to be the person asking someone who's just had a bad weekend how you feel.
Yeah.
because you know it's not good.
Yeah.
So you don't want to be the person putting pressure on, but we're in the entertainment business, we're in the information business as well. The reason Formula One is so popular is because there's so many stories and the drivers are crucial to that story.
Yeah. Do you get a different view on Formula One when you look from this side to the sport?
Yeah, it was very interesting. Actually, the first few seasons I did with Sky, I started to see myself in from a different point of view, because I suddenly realized that actually my paranoia as a driver was actually justified.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone else seems to know much more than you do. As a driver, I have blinkers on. I'm just interested in the car, the team, the track, and who I'm racing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested in what the teams down the back are doing. They're not my competition. So when you come into when you come into journalist side of things, you're supposed to know everything about all the teams, all the drivers, all the deals, and they watch everything you do. They see everything you say, especially with social media now. So somebody does a tweet,
mm-hmm.
and we go, oh, that's interesting. So the scrutiny that I was under, I felt as a driver, and I didn't like it. I realized I was justified in a, but what I didn't understand as a driver was how important it was to present yourself in this intensely scrutinized world in the right way. And if I'd known what I know now when I was a driver, I think I would have had a better time.
Yeah. Coming to you as a driver, you were the last world champion who didn't have a career in karting.
Yeah.
And you were quite a late starter. Yeah. After all, have you been surprised that you achieved what you have achieved without that school, let's say?
I would say yes. I would say it's extraordinary I ever managed to make it through. And it's only really because of a lot of luck. A lot of things happened in the matrix, so that is Formula One and seats becoming available and Nigel Mansell going to America. I mean, I was really lucky to get in at that point in time with so little experience in my 30s to drive in Formula One, starting a career at age 32. Was very unusual and not going to happen in this day and age.
So it was not a master plan that you said, I'm getting the test drive now with Williams, and sooner or later I will be a regular driver.
You always know there's a chance. If you've got it, if you're in the, you've got to be in it to win it, as they say. So, you know, if you're in the mix, something can happen. Mm. You just don't know. So as long as you're ready, as long as you keep pushing the door, then you never know. It might not open, but you know, sometimes if the door opens and you're not ready, then you missed your opportunity. So my plan was, I knew I was realistic. And I was told when I was very young, when I switched from bikes to cars. So when I was about 24, people said, you're too old for Formula One now. And, you know, and when someone says that to me, I just go, yeah. I try harder.
Yeah.
So I just thought, no, you're wrong. As long as, because I know that if I win in the categories I'm in, then I've got a chance of going up the ladder. But it is amazing that I managed to get into a top team at that time. But then I hit the ground running and I won races in my first season. So that was, it all worked out well.
Yeah. You said already you started your career on bikes. Did you learn there something which probably others who started a career on karting didn't experience, which was an advantage in the end for you?
The only thing I can think of is that we have a lot of power for a very small contact patch on motorcycles. So you become very, very attuned to the applying power and using. But honestly, other than that, I don't think so. I don't think there was much that was useful. I think when they race in karting in the wet, they're very sensitive to lots of power and no grip. And all these guys have raced on slicks in the wet, and you know they had that. But there's something about falling off that makes you a little bit extra sensitive. You don't want to hit the ground.
I mean, at the beginning of your career, obviously, it was all about finding money.
Not finding money.
Well, not finding money. When you look now on careers, people are either in a Red Bull program or Mercedes or Ferrari scholarship. Do you feel sometimes jealous? I mean, they still have to deliver on the circuit, but they don't have to find the money anymore.
I think every period has the same pressure, but in a different way. Mm. So if you're a Red Bull driver, you know Helmut Marko is going to say, you win or you're out.
Yeah.
This is, you know. But, you know, it's nice to have that, at least the chance. So there is people putting money and picking drivers up. And I think I lost a lot of years, but then I probably wouldn't have appreciated it. It's only when I got picked up with Cellnet. Cellnet was putting money into Formula 3, so I was selected, I think a little bit because they thought my name would help to promote stuff. But then I was against Martin Donnelly in Formula 3, and I knew that I had to beat him because I couldn't be just the guy who was there because he looked good or, you know, much prettier than Martin Donnelly, obviously. My name or something. Yeah. I'm just joking, Martin. Mm. Anyway, but you know, I knew I had to beat this guy because everyone rated Martin, so I had to be able to beat him, and he was really hard to beat. He was incredibly quick. So, I think I'm on the way up, proved some credentials as a driver. But after that ended, I was left with nothing, and I couldn't find money, and really, it was like being dropped from the Red Bull program. So. I think when drivers experience that, everything being taken away, they suddenly wake up. That's the point at which they either sink or they fly. I think we see this with Red Bull sometimes. You know, drivers. There are drivers who have incredible talent. You know, the Hamiltons and the Verstappens, or Häkkinen, and you just show them a car, and they're the quickest guy all the time. They keep going up and up and up, and they probably never. But even they have moments where they think, I could lose everything. Mm-hmm. And they respond in those moments. So I don't regret my career path, but I think I was quite talented when I was younger. I was getting very good on the bike, and I found it very difficult to get the leg up early. Mm-hmm. And if I'd had an earlier start, I think I could have, my best years maybe were lost, but yep. You don't know.
Yeah. Then you were there at Williams as a test driver, but you drove in 92 a few yeah. races for Brabham. Was it, everybody knew that Brabham was not competitive in that year. No. Was it, you did it because you had to grasp everything what was there and
again,
take the chance?
You're in it, you can show what you can do. Mm. And why do drivers now want to be reserve drivers and get just one session in the, you know, yeah. FP1 on a Friday? Nobody's watching. No. You know? But somebody's watching. Yeah. Somebody's, you know, they get the experience and they show they're up for it. And so Brabham was an opportunity to show I had the desire to race. I didn't want to be a test driver. I didn't want to just drive for Williams. I wanted to race. Mm.
And then the opportunity came up because Mansell was going to Indy. Patrese has already signed for another yeah. team. In your career, you started really with the best teammates you can imagine. First, Alain Prost, then Ayrton
yeah.
Senna.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have not chosen them, but
no.
how big was the pressure to, as a young guy, to go against these?
It's great because
icons.
You know, if everyone thinks these are the best guys, yeah. then you can, you know the gap. You know what the measure. You know what how you measure against them. And it's a huge motivation because yeah. you know, you're looking at Alain Prost's lap times and you're going, he's quick.
yeah.
You go and do a quick time, you're yeah. quicker than him, and then he goes quick again. You realize why these guys are so special.
Mm-hmm.
And Mansell, you know, and the way they work in the team. So a huge opportunity I had. I would love, obviously, to have spent the whole season with Ayrton, but mm-hmm. maybe he would have demolished me.
Yeah. So there was never the fear that you said, okay, they could kill my career, actually,
yeah.
because I'm still young,
no,
and maybe I have the talent, but I'm too young
yeah.
to stand against these
yeah.
these drivers.
Honestly, Michael, I didn't have a career. I was down and out.
Yeah.
In age 29, 30, I had nothing going, you know? And then suddenly things happened and my life changed and I got opportunities and I was so grateful for mm-hmm. the opportunity
yeah.
that, you know, if I was going to be beaten by Nigel Mansell and that only lasted a year, then at least I got to Formula One, or,
yeah.
you know, which was only 6 months or a year, 2 years before.
Mm.
I just thought I was never going to get, you know, I'd have to go and give it up.
Do you then understand your father, who actually chose to drive against the best driver of his era, Jim Clark? I mean, he
yeah.
didn't have to do it. He
no.
did it because he wanted it.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Maybe yeah. that's, I think it's not good to avoid the fight. I think if you look at the Senna-Prost era,
mm-hmm.
two of the best guys in the best car produced some of the most intense Formula One that we've ever had. Let me think of other examples. You know, any teammates where the best people are in the same team. It's like a prize fight. If you're going to see a boxing match, but you don't want to see one guy smash the other guy. You want to see the two big names in the same ring together. And seeing who's best. And I think they both benefited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think what happened was it showed the true character of Ayrton. Not always a very pretty sight.
Yeah.
And also put Alain under huge pressure as well, which, you know, I think he coped with incredibly well considering how intense and what the stakes were. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, where Michael really avoided, and maybe Lewis has avoided having a proper head-to-head. I mean, Lewis was with Jensen, and Jensen and Lewis were a good combination, and Alonso. I think the public liked to see.
Yeah.
So I don't want to go in to F1. I mean, if you can win everything and never have to have a fight,
yeah.
what's the value?
Yeah. I mean, then you had a very good first season at Williams. I mean, you could have even become champion for a while. You were in the mix, and
had
there
really.
Not been
the
British Grand Prix
yeah.
where he stopped, and the German Grand Prix where he
yeah.
had technical trouble, could have been much closer still. Did you think after that experience, I'm ready for Senna as well?
I wanted to, yes. I think basically I had never considered myself a title contender. I thought I was going to be a good understudy to, you know, to Alain. And but when I was getting better, and there was no question I was getting better. And I don't think, I mean, I think if I had hung on to Ayrton's ankles, I could see that happening. I don't think I could have beaten Ayrton over a season. I don't think. I have to be honest. You know, I think he was too fierce a competitor, too quick.
Okay.
I would have got better trying to get close to him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I know Mika, you know, out-qualified Ayrton and raced against him. And, you know, maybe it wasn't impossible. I always took the view that they're only human beings. But, you know, my short experience with Ayrton was that he was fearsomely quick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did Alain Prost and Senna have in common, and what was different?
Okay, so in my experience of having just experience. Been in a team with them, very different way of working, Alain. But I think I can't judge Alain on the experience I had with him, because he had a year off and then he came back in. But he was quiet, you know, very quietly got on with things. He was very, he played very gently with things. He didn't make big, it wasn't very, he got on with his job and just basically went out there and did laps and learned about the car and found a balance, found what he wanted. And then as a teammate, he was very charming and polite and everything. With Ayrton, a little more difficult to get to know, a little bit more of a big name and a star, quite formal, I would say, and also not intense, as we know. He often had a frown on his face and wanted to understand. He was learning Williams. You know, and a different team, first time for a long time. Yeah, so I think he looked concerned the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even I'd say even worried. Mm-hmm. You know, but he was fine with me, but slightly suspicious of me, maybe, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Not that he had to be, but anyway, different characters. I think more aggressive in driving style than Alain.
This year was the transition from active to passive suspensions, and Williams was obviously the leader in that technology, and you knew this active suspension very well because you tested it, you drove it, and in races. Did you have the feeling at the beginning of 94 these cars are kind of dangerous or difficult, more difficult to drive, nasty in their reactions?
Oh, I mean in 94, when we went back and they took away the active suspension, went to passive. Well, there was some unlearning that had to be done. So the car that we started 94 with was not set up right. So it was difficult. We were in the process of setting it up and getting some balance on it, but it was a bit of a beast to drive, honestly. And I think that there was challenges in, I don't know what actually happened, but because Williams had been focusing so much on the active side of things, they'd kind of they seem to have forgotten how to do the passive car. So we didn't have the right setup on the car to start with. And we were working on that and we were making progress. And we did get there eventually in the end. That was all after Ayrton and Imola. Mm-hmm. So Ayrton driving that car, I mean, I knew how hard that car was to drive. So the things he did with it, particularly in Brazil, but even he spun off at the end. I mean, I think he must have been exhausted. Because I found it like it was it was really tough to run.
Yeah. Then came Imola. We all know what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, you were the teammate of Ayrton. You drove then the second part of the race. Was it the hardest race ever you drove mentally?
I think it was, the story is that, I mean, we knew that something had happened to Ayrton at the restart and that it was not good, not promising. So we were, I didn't know he was dead. Mm-hmm. So you did the race, you carry on because you you want to be doing something to fill in, you know, to somehow give some hope. But it was a bit of a, you know, I don't think they should have really carried on with the race, honestly. Looking back, they probably should have stopped.
And
we should have gone home, but yeah.
But you said also in your book you trusted that there was nothing wrong with the car. Was it because you wanted to believe it, or
were you trusted? No, I think when you go in this sport, if someone prepares the car for you, they they've done the best they can. They don't want to have anything go wrong. So for me, it was an important bond. You know, it's the bond. It's the relationship you have with your team. They give you the car, and you trust that they are doing everything right. And if they said it's okay to drive, then I would completely believe them. So I drove the car, you know.
So later on, it became a really intense season, a battle between you and Michael.
Yeah.
How much rivalry was there in between you? I mean, on a personal level, or was it more made up by the media? Or
made up by German press.
Yeah.
So, naturally, it was an intense season because of Ratzenberger and Senna and the changes, the politics. There was massive politics. There was Benetton up to tricks and the FIA. So there was so much
rule changes.
Global coverage of this sport because of the issues. And in it, the middle of it, was a championship being fought out with a guy who everyone said, well, he's number two. Against this new guy, Michael Schumacher, at that point, nobody knew how good he was. And so it was an interesting season. There was a lot of pressure. And I had never led a championship before. The only championship I'd ever won until that point was champion of brands on motorbikes.
Yeah.
So I had a new experience being in the spotlight, a lot of pressure. And some things I did well and some things I didn't do well. But I think I got the best out of myself in that season. And Michael pushed me to the maximum. And I gave the maximum I'd ever given in a car and in Suzuka to keep the championship alive. And then after then, we went straight to Adelaide and we carried on.
Yeah.
We carried on. Our pace was so incredibly quick that we'd used up, by the time we'd stopped in Adelaide, the mechanics told me that I'd used up as much brakes as Nigel had used for the whole race.
Okay.
So the pace was pretty hot.
Okay. Suzuka was the race of your life. Have you ever found out later on why it was just there? Why on that day?
I think because I knew the chips were down. I knew that I had to beat Michael to keep the championship alive. And so I was determined to push myself to the very maximum, and the conditions were extreme, and that made it ever so challenging. You know, the maximum challenge race against Michael Schumacher in the wet monsoon for a world championship, one of the toughest circuits. So I drove out of my skin in that race when the last lap, I don't even remember being in control of the car. It was just almost like the throttle was stuck wide open and I was just hanging on. And I managed to increase the gap to Michael.
Yeah. Did you know afterwards, I never will have a race like this again in my life? Or when did you realize?
I knew it was extreme. I knew it took a lot out of me. It frightened me, actually, to be honest. I actually got out of the car and I was actually shocked because it was almost like I'd gone slightly mad in the car to go that fast. And it's quite scary, you know, because, you know, I was quite relieved to be out of the car. Yeah.
The funny thing is, not only on the circuit you were beating Michael, also mentally on that day, because I think in the break between the two races, from what I've heard, you were sitting in the car very quiet, stoically concentrating, whereas Michael was running up and down as the people were telling me and asking questions, can we do this and this and that? Right. That is very strange because you thought it would have been Michael's role to be more in control. Yeah.
I think Michael was, he showed, sometimes he showed, he didn't like pressure at all. He didn't like anyone getting close to him, and he didn't like it when it wasn't easy to beat someone. He threw a switch a little bit. And you see a little bit of that with Vettel sometimes as well, I think. Anyway, that's me being the commentator now, the sports commentator. So what can you do? And in a situation like that, you have everything prepared. You need to just focus on the job. In actual fact, when I came in for my last tire change, they couldn't put a new wet tire on the left rear. Mm-hmm. And so they just had to keep it on. So that tire did the whole wet race.
Yeah.
And was bald at the end. So I didn't even have four good tires. So I'm especially pleased about that.
Then came the final, the famous final in Adelaide, and there was a crash between you and me. And I remember I had an interview with you 2-3 weeks later in Brands Hatch. I don't know why we met at Brands Hatch. And you behaved like a gentleman. I was expecting to say, okay, he did it on purpose or whatever. He screwed my championship. Difficult to be a gentleman after such an incident?
I take the view that you go into a race and things are going to happen. And the point of having stewards and all that there is that they are there to say, okay, that's, you don't do it like that, you do it like this. And so you kind of leave it to them. If you have, if I was to come away and go, oh, I'm really cut up about losing. I didn't see that I'd lost the championship. I saw it that Ayrton got killed and he was going to win the championship. Mm-hmm. And I was going to try and stop Michael from winning the championship as best I could. And I got very, very close, and I nearly won the championship. But we collided, and there was some confusion on my part because I didn't know his car was damaged.
Yeah.
So actually, I just thought he was weaving, and I did a clumsy move. I mean, it wasn't a beautiful take. It was a bit of a dive, but my this is where my motorcycle brain came in.
Yeah.
In motorcycling, if you put your bike down, at least when I was racing, they didn't turn in, but in karting they do it all the time. So instinct takes over, I guess.
Okay. Would you have attacked him if you had seen that he had brushed the wall?
Of course not. I would, I knew he was damaged, I would have just let him park a car, then I would have just given him a wave. But that's not how it happened. And these incidents. Being in a sport like Formula One, the things people remember are things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I played my part. I did it honorably, I think. I did my bit. And you move on to the next, and you look forward to next season. So I went, okay, we parked that one. Didn't happen. But this, when you look at the season, I 94 was my second full season of Formula One. I finished second in my first season, and I finished second in my second season. I nearly won. So that was a good trajectory.
Yeah. So I guess 95 was then quite a big frustration or disappointment.
Oh, massive. Yeah. 95 was a disaster. Mm. I mean, I think it caught up with me. I think all the drama of 94 caught up with me. I didn't have enough time to breathe over the winter. I didn't know where I was. I wasn't experienced in this, fighting for a championship. And when you look at the way Lewis manages his time, he makes sure he gets breaks, he makes sure he gets away, and he recharges and comes back ready for the season. And I didn't do that in 94. I was wanting to go, okay, let's do it again. And I just blew 95. I mean, it wasn't entirely disastrous. I won races. In actual fact, someone reminded me of Monaco in 95. I got pole position in Monaco by 8/10 of a second off of Michael.
Yep.
And I was 1.2 seconds quicker than my teammate. So there was still, the speed was there, but I got more, I let the rivalry and the rivalry with Michael get the better of me. And I made a mistake. I made a mistake tactically, off track, I think, in that year.
How was then the moment when you actually realized I'm champion? It was already during the race when once Jacques has gone off in Suzuka. You knew. Whatever happens, I'll be champion. How is that feeling?
Strange, because I still
wanted to go jump up and down.
I said on the radio, "Can I stop now?" Yeah. And they said, "No, you got to carry on. Yeah. You've got Michael behind you." So I had a luxury race. You know, I could win at quite an easy pace, and but it was also sad, tinged with sadness, because when I got out of the car, I knew that'd be the last time I would ever drive for Williams.
Yeah, I mean, how strange was that? Yeah. You won half of the races this year.
Yeah,
I think you qualified each race for the front row, and still you were told, or first you heard it as a rumor, I think, that you have to leave. I mean, how did you take it? And
well, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I just thought, how does this world work? How does this form? The way I looked at it was, if I want to keep my drive, I have to win. But if I couldn't keep my drive, even if I won, then that seemed really bizarre to me. It was strange, and that's where I was not, you know, doing this job. We started talking about Sky and working for the Sky. You can see the strategy, and you can see the way that the pieces are moved on the board before the time that they are done, that they are moved. So you know, at that time, I was naive about that, and I didn't have good advice from the people I was employed to give me advice. And so I got caught out by the chessboard.
Yeah. I think even Frank felt a little bit uneasy, because it took a while for him to tell you the
truth. I think what happened is, Michael, in 90, they were looking for a new engine deal. And they eventually went with BMW, if you remember. So they were looking to change from Renault, and they wanted to get a German driver to clinch the deal. So I think Frank signed Frentzen in 95, signed an option, I think, on 95 for Frentzen. And then Jacques turned up, and because 95 was so bad, I think he signed Jacques and Frentzen, thinking that in 97 it would be Frentzen and Jacques. And so there was no, and he couldn't get out of those contracts. So when it came to me doing well in 96, it was like, oh dear, what do I do now? And I think he tried, just people I've spoken to say, I think he tried to change the deal, but he couldn't.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Then had to drive for Arrows. I think it was the only team left you could get at the time.
Well, it was the only team would give me a one-year deal.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Everyone else wanted a two-year deal. Mm-hmm. So now I'm thinking more strategically, because I'm thinking, I knew that Adrian was going to McLaren, so I knew I needed to be in McLaren in 98.
Okay.
Which would have been good.
Yeah.
So that's his plan. So I went to Arrows 1 year. Mm. Arrows works out. If Arrows becomes great, fantastic. I've got Arrows.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, then I work on McLaren. So I worked on McLaren during that season, and but Ron, I couldn't get on with Ron.
Yeah, okay.
So he didn't give me a very sweet deal, as they say. It was a very unappealing deal. Yeah. I thought, well, if they don't really want me, having to go through the process of proving yourself as a driver in Williams, and then having to do it again, because the deal, the way he put it, was that, you know, Ola, if you're any, we'll try you, but if you're any good, then we'll pay you. Yeah. What? I'm world champion. Come on. And so I think he did it to upset me, and it worked. Yep. So I said, bye, forget it. So I lost. That was my last chance, really, at becoming having another championship.
Okay, yeah. But you ended up at Jordan, and at least you got a chance for one more win.
Yeah, yeah. That wasn't a bad move, actually, because they were on the up, and they worked well getting performance, and they went on, after I left, they went on to do very well.
Yeah. On that win in Spa, there was a lot of controversy, obviously. Eddie said on the radio that then he stopped more or less Ralf to attack you.
Right. Eddie misunderstood what I found out this when I played golf with him a few years ago. And he said to me, you said that you'd crash into Ralf if he tried to overtake you. And I went, never said that. Why would I crash into Ralph? Mm. I'm not that sort of person. So when I said to him on the radio, you need to think about team orders because you're in a position where you can win and have a first and second, your first ever win. Mm-hmm. But if we race, then we could tangle. It could go wrong.
Yep.
Anyway, he read that as meaning I was going to crash in. I'd rather crash into Ralph than give up a win.
Yeah.
And so he told Ralph, all right, that's not what I said.
Yeah.
I was just saying it's a sensible thing to do, to tell Ralph not to do anything silly.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Ralph, I know he doesn't believe that because he said so in a podcast I heard recently. But listen, it was never going to work, was it, with me and a Schumacher?
Yeah. Did Eddie ever tell you the story that Michael came at the evening of that race and really giving him a hard time, telling him you've stolen the victory of Ralph and I make sure that Ralph will never drive for you?
Apparently, there was a lot of upset there as well. But I gave Eddie, the way I look at it is I gave Eddie a victory.
Yep.
I showed them how to, because they were, as a team, they knew how to do what everyone else was doing. And I had to say, look, if you want to win, you can't do what everyone else is doing. You have to do the thing that no one else is doing. So there's a different mindset between Williams and when I went there at Jordan. The mindset was very much, we're going to keep close to those people. And I had to say, look, you've got to get out of that mindset. Mm. You know, the only people who win are people who go where no one else has been before. And so there's a different way of looking at things.
In 99, I mean, Jordan had its best season ever, but it was not your best season. What happened in 99?
No, 99, I don't know what happened exactly. Everything was going well, and then suddenly Frentzen was very quick, and I couldn't understand why he was suddenly so much quicker. And then I'd always got it in my mind I was going to retire, and I actually thought I wanted to retire at the British Grand Prix. So 99 was a bit of a catastrophe year for me because my mind, I think, had already started to give up. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, I don't want to get beaten, so I don't really want to be here if I'm going to get beaten.
Yeah.
And so can I get out of my contract? And then Eddie wanted to get rid of me there and then. And then I said, no, I want to finish at the British Grand Prix. That would be the nice way to go. I started the British Grand Prix. You know, why can't you just let me go after the British Grand Prix? Oh, no, we got to. So then we had fights over breach of contract, and it was a nightmare. Mm. And then eventually he said, okay, you stay, but you have to stay to the end of the season. I went, what? So I had to stay.
Yeah.
And like, otherwise I get sued.
Yeah.
So it was a horrible year.
And how difficult is it then to drive a car when you know already like to retire?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not a good place to be. And and Bernie commented, I think, he said, listen, when a driver sees the red light, they have to stop immediately.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
You cannot drive in the back of your mind thinking this is my last season or my last race. When it got to my last race in Suzuka, we'd had a crash on the first lap, and then I was 20th or something, and I was two laps down, and I just thought, well, what's the point? I'm not risking my life now after all this just to finish. Yeah. And so I pulled him.
Yeah.
Eddie was very upset. But you know, it's my life.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You know, there comes a point as a driver when you have a right to take that decision over your well-being, rather than just play roulette with not only my life but my family's life.
Yeah, yeah. So there is then actually the fear that something could happen, although Formula One is not more unsafe than it was before when you haven't been in that situation.
Listen, it's always a chance something can go wrong in all kinds of motorsport. Mm. Or anything. I mean, look at Michael, who was skiing. You know, there's always a chance when you're taking a risk something can go wrong. So if you're in a Formula One race, even if it's maximum safety, you know, things fall off cars, things break, you know, it happens all the time.
You didn't extend your career like many other drivers in Le Mans, in touring cars or whatever. Why? Why was
because
it for you the...
There's two reasons, I suppose. One is there's nothing like F1. Mm-hmm. You get the best of everything in F1. As a driver, the professional, the teams and everything. And I think I fell out of love with driving. And also I respected people in other categories more than that. You know, they're specialists in what they do. They're not easy to beat. You can't just turn up as a Formula One driver and win in another category, it's DTM or World Endurance, you know, you're going to be up against highly professional guys who have been doing it a lot longer than you have. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be hard to beat. And then, you know what F1 drivers are like? They don't like being beaten.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So if you're going to go there, yeah, you're going to have to push yourself just as hard as you would do as if you were an F1. Mm. And I didn't want to.
Yeah.
I'd done it. I'd like 40 years old. You know, you're talking about footballers, yeah, you know, stopping when you're 30. I mean, yeah, 40 is a good innings for a sports person.
Yeah. Have you been prepared for this other life after racing?
Well, I actually didn't want to do anything. I wanted to have time to think because I felt like I'd been on a, I'd been on a mission for so long that I wanted time to just, okay, everyone leave me alone. I'm going to take the kids to school. I'm going to spend time with my family. I've earned a lot of money. I've got a nice house. I can just see what comes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did things I like doing.
Yeah.
And I didn't have there were businesses which I got involved in, which I would rather have not had got involved in. But, you know, you get, you're a commodity, and so you have a value. And so people somehow persuade you. And I mustn't complain. You know, I wanted to do these things, yeah, myself. So I was rather, but I dabbled. I didn't go wholly invested into,
okay,
these things. I just dabbled with some businesses, and they take up so much bloody time, and then you try and get out of them. And so my nice retirement thing didn't turn out quite like I expected, but I learned a lot in the process.
Okay. I mean, we're coming now at the end to this book you wrote, which is an incredible book, I have to say. I only can recommend it.
Thank
and in
you,
this
Michael.
Book, you describe a little bit, you had a hard time then after your retirement.
Yeah.
I mean, also
so,
mentally,
I think,
to come over that.
Yeah. I think there's a crisis of identity that, yeah, people have when they're not racing drivers. You know, you become defined. You invest so much in being a racing driver. I think most drivers feel this when they stop. They don't know who they are anymore. You know, well, if I'm not a racing driver, then who am I and what do I do? And so you have to find your way through that process. Plus, there was still a lot of stuff to do with my dad. Dad died when I was 15, and so there was quite a lot of unresolved grief, I would say, about, mm-hmm, about that. I never really dealt with it. And I had my own family, and so I didn't want them to experience what I'd gone through. I wanted them to have, you know, but it was, I mean, it's post, you know, slightly post-traumatic, I think. So I had to go through, I was in therapy for a long time.
Mm.
And that helped a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you get a chance to talk like we're doing, but much more openly. And you can talk about anything in a room with a professional therapist, and you can resolve or hear yourself, and you can understand yourself. You understand that there are things you say sometimes and you suddenly think, well, that's not me. I don't think that. Why did I just say that?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting process.
Mm-hmm.
And you get more to the bottom of what your life is about and your journey is about. And that eventually led to me being able to put it all in the book, I suppose.
I mean, when we started the talk today, you said how difficult you found it to answer to private questions. And now all of a sudden in this book, you're so open.
Yeah.
And honest. Mm. How difficult was it for you to write that book?
Well, I'm a great believer in preparation before, yeah, you go anywhere. So it was not the right time. When I'd done years and years of understanding therapy, I also did a course in literature. So I did a degree in literature.
Mm-hmm.
And so I studied on that side as well. So I thought I knew a little bit about writing. I could spell anyway.
Mm.
But it's a fear of, when I was younger, I had a fear of I didn't know how to express myself, actually, is the,
mm-hmm,
truth. So,
mm-hmm,
you learn how to express yourself through the process. Writing can be a way of doing that as,
okay,
well.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got a chance to rewrite something, as long as you don't have a deadline,
mm-hmm,
too much of a tight deadline, which I did do with that book. But, you know, I felt more confident about what I was saying. And that came from therapy, and that came from just You know, I think I grew up. If you see pictures of me when I was younger and I'm at a racetrack with my dad or something, I'm usually scowling because people are always taking pictures of me and I didn't like people painting. Mm. I didn't have the opportunity to. So I think I was quite closed in and internal as a person. So when I came to be an F1 driver, the scrutiny I didn't like at all. But now I've learned a little bit more about how, you know, I can play the game and I can be in the mix with people a bit more openly. Mm-hmm. And Sky, working with Sky, I have to say, has prompted this a little bit because they were asking me questions about mine. And I was going, I don't want to tell you all this, you know. And so now I've written the book, I can tell. I can talk about it because I have sold the book. Yeah. But, you know, it's you start to see yourself. You start to. It's like going out. It's like going away from Earth. It's like the moon, the shot from the moon, the Earth rise. Mm. It's you get a perspective and you can see yourself as others might have seen your career.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Damon. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you.
And I hope to see you then at the Grand Prix. I guess we will see each other.
Yes, you will. Yeah, I'll be there somewhere, having a coffee somewhere.
Yeah, maybe. I try to make it as well.
We'll be there. Well, thank you very much for if you've been listening and watching, and thank you very much.
Okay. Ja, liebe Motorsportfreunde, das war unser Gespräch mit Damon Hill. Ich glaube, es war unheimlich interessant. Wir melden uns wieder mit dem nächsten Interview. Bis dahin, Servus.
Wir hoffen, euch hat auch diese Folge Formel Schmidt gefallen. Sollte das der Fall sein, würden wir uns sehr freuen, wenn ihr den Podcast bewertet, abonniert und uns weiterempfehlen würdet. Und schaut auch gerne bei unseren Kollegen Jens Dralle und Sebastian Renz vorbei. In ihrem Podcast Übersteuern geht es um das pure Automobil. Egal ob bulliger V8 oder Elektroauto. Kein Thema bleibt bei Übersteuern unbehandelt.